His Holiness is saying Merry Christmas to everybody. Today is the 25th of December.
I think some of you may be missing the Christmas big dinner.
We are right now on page 154, and we're going to we are at this word also. Also, we don't give the merit field. That's where we are right now. Thus, if petitioning the merit field is so crucial, you may now be wondering, how should I go about doing this? So I shall explain this process, beginning with the Swift Path version of the merit field, because each Lamanam text has its own version of the preparatory rites. At this point, you may be wondering, before I can begin the visualization of the merit field, I should dissolve the refuge visualization. How should I do this, since the textbooks are not clear on it? There are, in fact, three different Guhya Samaja merit field also talks about dissolution of the merit field through the Miktsima mantra. Which dissolves... So there are, in fact, three different instructions on the dissolution of the refuge visualization. They are not discussed explicitly so as to give you some leeway. These instructions are: the refuge visualization turns into yellow light, which dissolves into the space between your eyebrows, or you imagine the visualization becomes sealed into unfocused emptiness, or the whole refuge visualization rises into space, and after you have visualized the merit field below it, you merge the refuge visualization into the merit field when the time comes for the wisdom beings to enter the merit field. These three instructions are left vague, as you have to receive them orally and in person. The first step of visualizing the merit field is the consecration of the earth surface. You recite Jambil Hindu's ornament for the thoughts of the fortunate. May the ground everywhere have no pebbles, and so forth. Be flat as the palm of one's hand. Have the nature of lapis lazuli, yes, yet remain soft. You must not think. All the following takes place within the confines of your room. You visualize that the ground surface is vast, as if you are in the middle of a vast plain. This surface is flat and either made of gold inlaid with designs in lapis lazuli or of lapis inlaid with designs in gold. The surface yields when touched and recovers its shape when there is no pressure. Its very touch is blissful. The surface is dotted with precious trees, and various magical birds in trees and sing of Dharma. There are pools of water whose bottoms are covered gold dust. The whole plain is surrounded by mountains of jewels and so on. Visualize in accordance with the sutra on the layout of the pure field. The pebbles also include rough stones and clay shards. People in India used to throw away old containers, and the country was littered with clay fragments. The surface is free. I used to sometimes say the magical scripture, magical text, we think maybe something outstanding. That's probably wrong, because Lama Tsongkhapa, as we said just now, he's greater in Middle Path Lamrim, and his commentaries on the Middle Path view, and his lecture setting on the perfection commentary on perfection Vida wisdom, and his commentary on Tantra, and his commentary on Guhya Samaja, Namsha Ribe Namshe, and then and his commentary on Guhya Samaja, Zogrim Jingwa Sedun, which is a commentary to Nagarjuna's Rimga, and so on. These are actually the real secret lineage, or the, rather the whispered lineage, magical scriptures. We shouldn't think that there exists a magical text apart from these. That's a wrong view, because sometimes we have this trend to think that menga means the direct instruction is something very precious, and then the other teachings are less important. For example, Abhisamaya Alankara, the name itself is Tenjo Ngomboto Bebing, the instruction of the Abhisamaya Alankara. So this is really true. This is the real instruction, direct instruction of Asanga. And also regarding the profound view, the emptiness, the near, the nominal phenomena. This is the real instruction of Nagarjuna. There's no manga instruction apart from these. So if we say, it still insist that there is a magical sort of a profound extraordinary instruction apart from this, then it's a sort of a false idea. Tsongkhapa himself has said, we have already said this earlier, instruction doesn't mean something that lies away or apart from what is already said in the the classical treatises. So we have to preserve the 8 volumes of Tsongkhapa and study them, and then implement what is said there into our path. So if we do that, then whatever is there, said to be there about this magical whispered lineage, magical text, is already there. And that is the practice of the whispered that text. That's what I think. So because when you study these texts, then that really moves one's heart, not in small measures, but in a huge, extensive way. So if you don't have good intelligence, then it's not your fault. But here in the three monasteries, you are studying for 20 to 30 years extensively. Tsongkhapa has said that in one text, which said, which goes in, it's in the Lamrim Chemo, that there's no secret instruction apart from what you have already studied in the major classical scriptures. So therefore, whatever we have studied in the classical treatises, if we don't know how to implement them into our practice, then it's our mistake. It's our mistake. We can be assured that there's no secret instruction apart from these. Earlier, there's one person called Chöba Thunden. He's a great practitioner of Chö. And many people followed him, and then it sort of affected negatively students' study in the three major studies, universities, monasteries, and as a result, Dema Tongpo wrote a critique or criticized this. So the study in the three monasteries, the syllabus and the program is extremely important. That's why the 13th Dalai Lama introduced a program of examining the better students of the three monasteries and then putting them in higher positions in the Gelugpa hierarchy. So, in earlier times, some upper tantric and lower tantric abbots were obtained that position, even though they were not that qualified. So the Dalai Lama prohibited them from going ahead and attaining to the seat of Shabha Cheje and Changzhi Cheje. And then he introduced the system of promoting only those who are really good in the Buddhist philosophy. And the first monk, that batch of scholarly monks who got promoted was Ganden Tipa Yeshi Wonte, who later on became the Ganden Tipa. As far as the profound view is concerned, many Tibetan lamas have written on the profound Tibetan profound view, but who can match their commentaries of Nagarjuna and also Chandrakirti Siksel, which is a commentary of the Madhyamaka Mulakarika of Nagarjuna? Extraordinary work. Who can match these works among... So therefore, you students here, monks here, should understand and realize that you have the gem in your hand and should not waste it and utilize your opportunity properly. Here the text is talking about the Guru Yoga, Guru Puja text written by... we have to think about, a particular point from many different angles, not just like one perspective. And then we will get a good sort of purview of everything. In Agusher Gyatso's writings, it is said that when it's blessing the Torma of Jigche, at the preliminary Torma, the Yamaraja mantra, the Yamantaka mantra, there's one section which says it's the mantra is just for blessing. Used to just set just for blessing, and then later using that mantra, saying that mantra to by off making as an offering by visualizing Yamantaka. However, in the so he's following the Wensa Yingyu, the Wensa was a whispered lineage, and he has said that he's criticizing the other tradition. In Penje Panti Yishi, he has said that when earlier Wensa, they are holding the Wensawa tradition and criticizing the Sikyu lineage, but nowadays we have adopted the Sikyu tradition also and mixed the two, and now we can no longer afford to criticize them. So the main thing is, even though we sort of interpret the meanings of some texts here and there, like Guru Yoga, like that, but when it comes to the real foundational treatises, the classical texts, we cannot interpret in differences. We have to leave them right there. And Tsongkhapa is different because when he interprets, expounds on, writes commentaries, he really based completely on Indian works. Therefore, his works are different. I I have written a text on in praise of the 17 Mahapandits of India, because I'm not that scholarly, but I had strove very hard to write that, because I think these 17 Pandits have done left behind a great legacy for Buddhism. We praise, make prayers to 17 arhats, but we don't have even a single text in the name of the 17 arhats. There's one written by Prince Rahula so the 87 arhats are said to be residing surrounded by 500 arhats. But how much legacy we have of these 17 Mahapandits of India? Sorry, earlier I said 17 arhats, it's not 17, 16 arhats. But 17 Mahapandits like Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and so on and so on. So these are the great, they have done enormous deed for Buddhism, for the Dharma. They work, their treatises sort of are the key to the Buddha's teachings, scriptures. They are like sort of eye-opener to us. So they, with their help, we are able to understand the meaning of the two truths, as I've said in that that prayer that I've written. So just as I said yesterday, every time I sort of boast and say that we are the inheritors of the Nalanda tradition. If we find out where is this Nalanda tradition among us, it really sort of it's here that you in this assembly, the monasteries are the ones who is carrying on this lineage. So you, whether it's the teachers, you or the students or the monks, whoever you are, so you should always realize that this burden, this responsibility lies on your shoulder. The three monasteries, if the tradition of studying the three, the classical texts and treatises of the Nalanda tradition declines here, then the Nalanda tradition declines altogether. It doesn't matter, even if in some pockets of monasteries some people are studying the Nalanda tradition, that won't make much difference. So now here it's talking about the combination of bliss and emptiness. And so first you have to think about emptiness. It's not enough to just say by word bliss and emptiness. Detong, the meaning of detong, bliss and emptiness, should be felt in the heart. First, the profound view is important. Without that, there's no chance, no point in visualizing, doing self-visualization of deity. And visualization merit field also cannot be done without profound view, because that is based on the visualization of the deity by visualizing first, perceiving emptiness. So therefore, a good understanding on emptiness, even if like just a very crude one, is indispensable. So right from the beginning, when you say in the Dedong Yirme Halam Yangba, in the great vast part of the deities, the heavenly beings, out of the sphere of bliss and emptiness, then so regarding bliss, you can imagine there's a bliss, but just sort of just feel it, you are feeling it. But the profound view must be there, at least even if it's just a minute understanding. So when it says, okay, His Holiness stopped here. So, regarding this bliss, bliss is something that arises due to the movement of the elements in the body, and another bliss is. I think His Holiness said it's another bliss is the bliss of the dissolution of elaborations, the calming down of subduing all elaborations, and meditating on emptiness. So His Holiness is right now on page 156. To practice Guru Yoga, you have to receive the instruction of Lama Chöpa, Guru Yoga. However, in order to practice the seven Jojigyasan Ringye, the preparatory rites, one is not required to obtain the guru instruction on guru puja, guru yoga. So there's some kind of a construction there, and that's why it is said that there's a sort of a confusion there, and it's said that we don't know how to explain this. So at this point, His Holiness, I think here in the Guru Yoga starts by here. In space, the broad road used by gods, seen as bliss and void, combined at the corner of overlapping banks, a cloud of Samantabhadra's offering sands. Stands a wish-granting tree, black, bead-decked with leaves, flowers, and fruit. At its summit is a precious throne ablaze with five colors of light. On this rest a huge lotus with sun and moon disc. On these sits my Garuda Guru, who is thrice kind to me. He is the nature of all Buddhas in aspect, a saffron-robed monk with one face, two hands, and a radiant smile. His right hand makes the Dharma teaching mudra, the left the gesture of meditative absorption. While holding a nectar filled with begging bowl, he wears the three bright saffron Dharma robes. On his head is a yellow pandit's head. At his heart, a Shakyamuni and blue Vajradhara of one face, two hands, holding bell and Vajra. Vajradhara sits in union with Dattvishwari. They experience bliss and void combined. They wear precious ornaments and robes of celestial skills. At this point, your mind apprehends the primordial wisdom, inseparable bliss and emptiness. Page 157. Emptiness and appearance. And the appearance of this wisdom is made to make take the form. So His Holiness is much further down. Page 158. Yeah, it's 158. Next, you must visualize the main figure on this lotus space. Who is the main figure of Guru Puja Merrifield? Some say he's Jai Rinpoche. Others say he's your root guru. Some even call him the Guru Puja Jai Lama. But he's called Lama Lobsang Thoban Dorje Chang. He's called Lama because he's your own Lama. Lobsang because he's Tsongkhapa, whose ordination name was Tsongkhapa Lobsang Dorje Thakpa. Tuwang because he's our teacher, Shakyamuni, and Dorji Chang because he's the Buddha Vajradhara. So he's four things, yet the four are an inseparable entity. This is the principal peak of merit field visualization. Does that mean we must think that the four different mind streams are combined together into one? This is not what in fact happens. How could we make four different mind streams into one? The four have been one entity right from the start. We may take them to be separate mind streams, but there are proofs using logic and scriptural authority that should convince you that these four are in fact one. The four are the one entity, but for us, Vajradhara is blue, holds a vajra and bell, and wears the costume. Sambhukha Kaya Shakyamuni has a seven. Your titulary deity, Kirurumche, has said that if all the Buddhas are one continuum, it's wrong because it's like the views of the non-Buddhist Hindu Indian traditions. There's some kind of objection there in his Kirurumche's works. But generally, when we say the three lineage Buddhas, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Vajrapani, who are symbolizing the power, wisdom, and compassion, it sounds like they are of not continuum, not one continuum. However, if we, like, who are those who practice, consult, rely on Vajrapani and attain Vajrapani state of Buddhahood, and then those who rely on Manjushri and attain Manjushri state of Buddhahood, and those rely on Avalokiteshvara and attain Buddhahood, and when they attain Buddhahood, their continuum should be different. This is Kirubhiji, which said that. But at the state of Buddhahood, their qualification are same. Their continuum are different. So this is one way of saying. However, when you're talking in terms of, in the context of Guhya Samaja, like the principal deity in this mandala and all the surrounding entourage deity, assembly of deities surrounding him are in reality of one entity, one continuum. This is a sort of one way of explanation done because the practitioner sort of visualized in that way in order to purify the five impure elements of our physical body, our sort of constituent body. So there's sort of two different version to this. So His Holiness is here. When should thus Vajradhara and Shakyamuni are one entity. So here the text is talking about Shakyamuni, and Shakyamuni's Buddha's emanation. So His Holiness says there can be many emanations to Shakyamuni. However, if you say Nagarjuna and all the great masters are emanations of Shakyabuddhi, that's also a contradiction. Sort of. So the Buddha, some of them may be emanations of Buddha, and some may be like individual persons who follow the Buddha's teachings and then attain extremely high grounds and paths and attain Buddhahood. So they could be different types. But even after this, he appeared many times in India as pandits and adepts and taught the Dharma while in these forms. During the first dissemination of the teachings in Tibet, he appeared as Shakyashada Rakshita, Padmasambhava, etc., and taught the Dharma. In the second dissemination in Tibet, he manifested as many scholar adepts in order to teach Dharma, Adisha, Jatsangapa, and so on. So Jetsongkhapa Losang Thapa too is Shakyamuni by nature. So Buddha said that Shakyamuni Vajradhara in the future would take the form of gurus when the five degenerations prevail. So you may be wondering, who then is the emanation of Shakyamuni Vajradhara and that is supposed to be working now for my sake? His Holiness is referring to one line here. Look no further than your guru, the Shri Kasama Tantra says, all these beings are the embodiment of the five Dhyana Buddhas, appearing like actors or a faithful portrayed, that none as great bliss is but one, the one experienced in varied guises. You can take this quotation in many ways. It could apply to the isolation of the body level of the completion stage, or you could apply it to the way you should devote yourself to your spiritual guide as follows. Supposing a leading dancer puts on the black hat costume and then makes his entrance, people will say, here comes the black hat, yet it is only the dancer. Then he goes off and puts on the Dhammaraja mask, becoming the Dhamma protector Yama. And when he re-enters, people will say, that's Dhammaraja. But it's only the lead dancer himself. Though we designate him with different names, when he dons each different costume, he's still just the lead dancer. The victorious one, the Vajradhara, similarly appears in the aspect of Shakyamuni, Jetsongkhapa, or your own guru. Their different aspects aside, they are one entity. You should visualize the main figure of the merit field with like conviction. This figure has been given the name Lama Losa Thuwan Dojichang because he's even more. As it says, he's by nature all Buddhas. You must become convinced that the Guru is an entity that includes all the Buddha's primal wisdom embodied in the one physical form. I will discuss this in some detail in the section on devotion to a spiritual guide. Without a proper understanding of these things, your meditation on the Guru Yoga, no matter how profound, will only be a pale reflection. We find in the great stages of the path, which says, one should understand the foregoing to be the famous instruction called Guru Yoga, but nothing will come out of it if one meditates on it only a few times. The recitation refers three kinds of kindness. According to the sutric tradition, they are giving vows, transmissions and discourses. In the tantric tradition, they are giving major initiations, explaining the tantras and giving instructions. We say thrice kind because one receives all three from the one guru. Externally, the main figure takes the form of the victorious one, great Tsongkhapa, a monk clad in seven robes. They say this particular seven of the robes he wears is extreme, approximately the color of the ruddy duck. His right hand makes the teaching Dharma gestures. His left hand holds a begging bowl full of nectar while making the meditative absorption gesture. The thumb and the forefinger of both hands hold the stems of blue lotuses or utpala. Their petals are level with his shoulders. The sword of wisdom, is tipped lightly aflame, stands on the fully blossomed flower on his right. A copy of the 8,000 words perfection of wisdom sutra sits on the lotus to his left. This book speaks its content. You could also imagine the text is the one you are specializing on in your study, contemplation, and meditation. The three robes he wears are... So these are talking about the dress, the costume, the Lama Losam Thuwan Dojichan, the principal personage in the merit field, it has donned. So, His Honor is much further down than me. Page 161. So the five Dhyana Buddhas, symbols of the five aggregates, sits one on top of another. Each of their crown protrusions touches the lotus base of the Dhyana Buddha above it. So His Honesty is here is exactly like the Guhya Samaj body mandala in the Guhya Samaj instruction. There's a mention about the central knot is at the heart point. It's clearly mentioned in the Akusherab Gyatso instruction commentary. Samantha Bhatra, 360 knots, 8, 12, and emanating Samantabhadra from these knots. So His Holiness is here, I think, on page 162. Samantabhadra sits on his eight major joints. Actually, I said not here. The real words is joints. The recitation does not explicitly mention the five Vajra consorts, Vajra Rupa, etc. But as in the Grihasamaja body mother, they are in sexual union with some of these male bodhisattvas. The text says his skin pores are arhats. These arhats are not Shravakas and Pratyek Buddhas, but they are Mahayana arhats, that is, Arya Buddhas. In fact, each of the main figures' pores is a figure's pores is a Buddha field. Think that in these fields, infinite numbers of Buddhas are performing the 12 deeds. Some of them are subduing Mara, others are turning the wheel of Dharma, and so on. This is the meaning of the expression. All Buddha fields appear in a Buddha's body. One of the Avalokiteshvara's Lalitesvara Tantra tells us the name of each Buddha field in these pores, as well as the name of the Tathaka who decides that you should apply this information to all the Buddhas. Most of the texts give the number 21,000, but the actual number is not so fixed. Visualize the ten wrathful deities on and of the same nature as the 10 segments of his limbs. For example, Yamataka on his right hand. There are now 5 deities at the central figure's heart. The way these are placed is as follows. The biggest is Akshobhya, the Dhyana Buddha. Shakyamuni sits at his heart. Vajradhara is at Shakyamuni's heart. Mamaki sits in front of Akshobhya in sexual union with him. Manjushri, one of the 8 bodhisattvas, sits behind Akshobhya facing forward. The body of the main figure emits rays of light with various emanations at the tip of these rays, emanations such as the direction protectors and so on. Think that spirits such as Yakshas and Guyakas, Indra and Brahma, lie prostrate beneath the main figure's legs. Although you might not be visualizing all these very clearly, it is still vital to reach the conviction that your guru's aggregates, physical constituents, senses, etc. are really the 5 Dhyani Buddhas, the Tathagatas, in union with their conscious, peaceful and wrathful deities and so forth. So much for the way you visualize the main figure. Here's how you visualize his retinue. Light rays come out of the main figure's heart. Some go to the right and broaden. Upon them sits the Lama of the lineage of the extensive deeds. Others go to the left and broaden for the Lamas of the lineage of the profound view. Some rays go out front for the gurus who have taught you the Dharma in person. Others rays go behind. The Lamas of the lineage of the consecrated practice sit on this. So in the marriage feast days, the five sets of Lamas, His Holiness is referring to that. But on a slightly higher level than the other groups. Now, there are many profound points I could make on the way you arrange the members of the lineage of consecrated praxis. The most famous members of this lineage are Vajradhara, Tilopa, Naropa, Dombipa, Artisha, and so on. But as Duvan Gelegyas pointed out, in the profound extensive lineage itself, there is an undegenerated continuous stream of blessings from one Lama to the next. One therefore need not visualize another lineage. Khadulosang Gomjung, on the other hand, claimed that the consecrated practice lineage consists of members of the Guhyasamaj Heruka Yamantaka lineage. Jeng Awan Chamba and Lama Yongzhi Rinpoche claim it is composed mainly of 2 lineages, the 16 droplets of the Kadampa Tantra and the Geluk confidential lineage. Some of the terms used here are rather bit awkward because the translator has used in this text terms like Geluk confidential lineage. So His Holiness is again referring, saying here. It's His Holiness's page. His Holiness says if someone is doing self-entry ritual, One have to visualize all the mantra and the deities inside, in the front, not yourself in their form. In a Guru Yoga commentary written by Kansa Dorje Chang, there's a self-entry ritual. I received this instruction from Ling Rinpoche, and I practice that, recite that every day. And here in that, I visualize the entire Yamantaka mandala and the deities in the front. I think his honor is right here. Syllable letters by nature, the three vajras, body, speech, and mind, are visible on the three points of the bodies of the merry-field figures. That is a white om, the nature of the vajra body, and Varuchana Buddha. And on the crown of their heads, a red ah on their throats, and a blue hum at their hearts. Although the recitation texts do not explicitly say so, we are so. His Holiness is so. So, if you can imagine that all these deities in the front, you have visualized in front of you, are not inherently there, but rather they have all appeared from the void of emptiness and bliss in order to lead you, in order to bless you, and out of compassion appeared to you due to a special connection. If you can imagine in that way, it has a special sort of a purpose in moving your heart and inspiring faith, great devotion and faith in you. I think 160, His Holiness is 165, page number 165. This is illustrated by the stories telling how Asanga achieved visions of Maitreya or how Chandragomin did this with Avalokiteshvara. So the sages come before us as effortlessly as the moon's reflection appears on the surface of water in a pot. As soon as we begin to visualize the merit, the Buddhas come to us, but we do not see them. Similarly, we do not see, for example, the Nagas and spirits living in the water holes and wayside shrines. Still, His Holiness is referring to one prayer, which is a prayer about inviting the Buddha and his retinue of disciples, which says that you, the Buddha, have for eons, many countless eons, accumulated merit and practice in order to benefit sent beings, and then attain Buddhahood. So, and then in order to, so that particular line in that prayer, which is a prayer, which calls to the Buddha and said, you have for countless eons accumulated merit and practiced the path in order to attain Buddhahood to help sentient beings. Now is the time to help sentient beings because you have attained Buddhahood and you have taken rebirth in the world amidst sentient beings. So that word, that line, particular line, is a very powerful, very, very effective line, inspiring and moving line. So all these merit field and commitment beings, samaya beings, our visualization of Buddha, visualization of the merit field, and then the visualization of the commitment beings, samaya beings, dissolving into the commitment beings. Then visualizing that now we became a fully developed Buddha, and our conception that the wisdom beings are sort of inherent Buddhas, whereas commitment, these are all our misconceptions. It's not really like that. If one can do properly, from the very beginning, when one visualizes emptiness and then rise in the form of a deity, one has already risen in the form of a deity. And the only reason why you are doing the dissolution of the, the inviting the wisdom beings and dissolving them into you is to sort of reinforce that visualization. Page 166. It's now talking about the text is explaining about making offerings and make offering bath to the merit field and the Buddhas and the merit field. So it says a bathing pool is in the center of the building. The bottom of the pool is of crystal covered with a layer of gold dust. Center raised slightly higher than its edges. Like a turtle shell, the remain architectural details conform to the usual descriptions in the highest yoga tantras. They are the required number of wooden platforms or thrones to accommodate the members of the merit field. Walkways lead to these thrones or platforms. In each walkway, like that. I usually don't consider these things that important. Later on, we will come across one reference to Dom Dempers. He wears sort of a belt around his waist, which sort of makes six rounds to symbolize the six perfections. So this is in the mandalas. There is no bathroom actually, but we offer a lot of make a lot of offerings of drinks and foods to them. And the deities in the mandala also we also visualize as having the excretory organs. So at the same time, we don't visualize bathrooms in the mandala. So these are kind of like a little bit slightly strange, and the main purpose is to purification of our five aggregates, and then that's as due to that we do this practice of wisdom beings arising in the form of different aggregate deities. Some of these are really like hidden phenomena. So therefore, studying the sutra and the general Buddhist standard philosophy and logic is very important, and which explains on what is like direct knowledge, or is it, what is apparent, and what is inferred. Inferred knowledge, direct knowledge, and hidden knowledge. So, page 167. If you have implements for the bath ritual, use the bowl to represent the bathing pool. Pour a little water from your initiation's waist into the bowl. So it's kind of, it's on, it says that there are sometimes, there seem to be some contradictions. Here there's a reference to Dom Tempa. It says that Dom wears animal skin cloth and wears a belt around his dress, which makes sort of six circles around his waist. So, page number 169. Each figure, it says, each figure receives the appropriate costume, the garments of a peaceful deity or of a wrathful deity. Imagine that Dom Tempa receives a blue coat lined with lynx fur on the inside. He also receives a belt that is worn six times around his waist. His clothes symbolize that the path of the three scopes is covered by the six perfections. Doing this is a most auspicious gesture. Then the goddesses give the married field the appropriate ornaments and implements. Recite. Because the victors are naturally adorned with the marks and signs, they have no need of other ornaments. But I offer the best of jewels and ornaments so that all beings may obtain a body with these self-same marks. The figures then go up to resume the places while you recite. Because you, Bhagwans, love all beings and myself, I ask you to remain through your magic powers as long as I still make offerings to you. The old clothes left on the jeweled niches by the deities before they enter the bathhouses turn into light, which dissolves into you between your eyebrows. Alternately, you may imagine that a representative form of each of the six types of rebirth comes forward to receive his share of these relics. Six gutters come out of the bathing pool. These gutters take the bath water to the six realms. Feel that this water has removed all sufferings from all other beings. And also, as human beings are so insatiable, visualize that the water turns into goods to supply every imaginable human needs. Then think that the bathhouses, etc., dissolve into unfocused emptiness. Next is page 770, offering the seven limb prayer and a world mandala, practices that contain all the key points for accumulating merit and self-purification. This is the title. Then the text reads, Geshe Durba said, while you accumulate your collections of merit and purify yourself of obscurations, if you think that you are conscientiously petitioning your gurus and deities, even though you think these things will never happen, not in 100 years they will happen. So this is for all conditioned phenomena. They do not remain static. At some point you will develop them. Page 171. So the first limb homage, we are on page 171. There are three types of homage: prostrations of body, verbal homage, and mental homage. In the royal prayer of noble deeds, it is said, to all the Tathagatas of three times, those lines among humans, to be found in the 10 directions of the universe, I pay homage to each and every one of you, with cleansed body, speech, and mind. With this powerful prayer of noble deeds, I prostrate before all the virtues. Imagine I have as many bodies as there are atoms in the universe. According to the written teachings on this prayer, each body you could emanate should have infinite... regarding prostration, in the Indian tradition, when we watch them, they what we call as falling down like a trunk of a tree. They are doing prostrating in that way. So that is the right way to do. That means the whole body lying on the floor and then getting up. If this does not appear to you easily, it is enough to imagine that all the bodies you have been born into since beginningless time, but in human form. The prayer continues. On each atom there are as many Buddhas as the universe has atoms, and those Buddhas sit among bodhisattvas. So too do I believe that all victors fill the expanse of all phenomena. This verse means that every Buddha in existence can sit upon a single tiny atom. Suppose 100 people look simultaneously at one barley grain. That one grain occupies the eye consciousness of 100 people. The primal wisdom of all Buddhas can similarly be occupied with a single atom. The Buddha's physical body is also found on any atom engaging that Buddha's primal wisdom. This is a property of the unification, and is because their mind and energy winds are always found together. Prayer continues. I sing of the qualities of all the victors with an inexhaustible ocean of praise, with a great ocean of every melodious sound, and thus I praise all Sugatas. So the text goes on and on. I think we are on page 173. His Holiness is on page 173. Here the text is right now talking about prostration, how to do prostration, and the benefit of prostration like that, and the different versions of prostrations, different version of making a prostration. I think some might claim I'm going to do my preliminary retreat and then take shortcuts when they do the 100,000 prostrations. This is wrong. You must build up your accumulations and purify your obscuration. Your obscurations, page 175, right up until you reach enlightenment. Now, this is a practice combination of sutra and tantra. So, therefore, just as it is said in Guhya Samaj prayer, written by, composed by Tsongkhapa, these are very, very important. But the main thing is the combination of emptiness and bodhicitta. That's where we all get stuck and cannot go ahead, progress beyond that, because we lack enough understanding on these two, and also practice. Our practice is very weak in these two things. Page 175. You can usually pay homage when you go about your daily routine. When you are walking along a road and happen to see, for example, the symbols of enlightened body, speech, and mind, you should respectfully join your hands together. Even this becomes frustrating. They say that if you really know how to practice, you can convert every motion of your body into Dhamma. The second limb offering now is the second limb, which is offering. The royal prayer of noble deeds continues. I offer the victorious ones exquisite flowers, choice garlands, the clash of symbols, the best of lotions and of parasols, of oil lamps and choice incense. I offer the victorious ones exquisite robes, the best of eight fragrances, mounds of incense powders, high as Meru, a sublime array of matchless things. All these peerless, expensive offering, I imagine, for all the victors, In the Bodhisattva Charya, Jinju also there's mention of a vast, diverse, different kinds of aspects of offerings. Supreme offerings are the most sublime emanations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which they produce through their bodhicitta and prayers. Though we cannot make this kind of offering, there are things we can offer. The sutra requested by Sagaramati mentions two, upholding the Dharma and developing the wish for supreme enlightenment. The white lotus of compassion, His Holiness says, our sort of this habit of consulting horoscope or consulting astrology to embark on a mission or some kind of project is a great mistake. And also how to place a particular in what side we should sleep, how to place an altar like that. All these things, consulting astrology and is very wrong. Earlier when during a meeting at Mensika, Tibetan Medical and Astrology Department, the Tibetan medicine, Tibetan medicine is very good, very helpful and effective to many people. I said that. But I said I don't have much faith in Tibetan astrology or horoscope. And then after that, I heard that the staffs and the students in the astrology department felt greatly discouraged, demoralized by my statement. So next time I went there, I told them, I'm myself not interested in astrology, but I said that as a tradition, as a heritage, astrology is very important and you must study, you must preserve this tradition. And Ling Rinpoche used to say that he was born on the day of the meeting of nine bad people. Bad signs. He used to say like this. So when we are born, we cannot consult astrology, and also when we die, we cannot consult astrology. Our mothers cannot say, "I want to give birth to my child on an auspicious day." For example, if a mother tries to withhold the delivery of the baby until an auspicious day, then the baby might suffocate, get suffocated and die within the womb. So that doesn't make sense. So we cannot consult astrology or wait for a good date on the two most important occasion days of our life, birth and death. So, but if here among this crowd there are staffs from the medical and astrology department, don't feel demoralized because I'm saying so, because it's your. This is my personal opinion, and you as an expert in astrology must preserve this tradition for the sake of keeping an ancient tradition, keeping alive an ancient tradition. Nagarjuna said that it's not something, it's not from self, not from others, not from both, not from neither. So, and all the things, following lines in his Madhyamika Mula Karika, all like one after another, full of debates and critique and criticism and logic and reasoning. And Bhava Viveka's text is also from beginning to end packed with these debates and logic until the very end. So this is very important.
Page number 178. You offer a world mandala at this point. Manjushri's own verse differs from the sweet part and the easy part lamrims. According to these last two texts, you make your offerings first, then offer the world mandala. Manjushri's own verse says we should offer the world mandala first. This follows the practice of making a first offering to the Guru and so on. Mandala in Tibetan is Gilkor. Kil or center implies essence. Kor or circling implies extracting. Thus the word mandala means to extract the essence. This has great significance. Each shift, however, should confirm with your karmic propensities, so square mandalas and the like are acceptable. Some people claim external objects are not as important as inward meditative absorption, but in the Tantric context, we find that 50 verses on the Guru says, honor your Guru, your teacher, with mandalas, flowers, and folded hands. One day, Dom Tempo visited the great yogi Kumbhava. Kumbhava was spending his whole time in single-pointed meditation, and his mandala set lay neglected, covered in dust. Dom asked him why he was not offering. In the Gandhan Monastery, there is a very huge mandala. I think it's even difficult for people to carry it, so there is hang from ceiling with an iron hook or something tied to the beam. And so people, normally the rope is untied and being offered. So mandala is so huge, so even difficult to hold with one's hand. I teased with the Ladakh people in Ladakh recently. In the Jokhang temple in Ladakh, there are so many thrones in the center. There is Dalai Lama's throne, then Tibetan and other great teachers. And the cause was that when I was on a Mani retreat, about 3 weeks, later I went there. So inside the main statues, of course, the Lord Buddha. So beside the Buddha statue, there's so many statues. And when I went to make some offer, so I have to sit before my own throne. So today I came to see the Buddha, but not my own throne. So my own throne seems to be more important than the Joe's statue. So therefore, it was easier to... So later, so with this, sorry, there was interruption in sound. So recently, when I went to that temple, so all the thrones were removed, and it was easy for me to see the statue of Buddha, and I could prostrate before that. Then I told them, so your throne is similar to the Mongolian tradition. Just hang it on the ceiling. So when someone, master comes, then just untie the rope and let the throne come. When the teaching over, then just take away the throne. So the Ladakhi people are very kind. Most of the Himalayan region people are very kind. From Amman to Ladakh are all very faithful people. Page number 178, the second last para. So, debating about the cuff, the difference in the monastery. So, in Yudhya Tantric University, the tea cup is quite huge, or quite large compared to the Saragandhan and Drepung monasteries. The last para on page number 178, put a drop of perfume on your fingertips. You then either put your thumb in the center and move your fingers around the rim, or you put your fingers on the center and move your thumb around the rim. Make the offerings as follows. Hold the mandala base in your left hand with the little grain. Rub the base many times with your right forearm. Imagine you are wiping away your sins and obscurations. Then rub the base 3 times in the opposite direction. Imagine your lifespan, body, speech, and mind are therefore based. So in order to, if you are offering the mandala in order to gain accumulation, and also if it is for some supplication, since we are taking the blessing from the master, so it has to phrase ourselves. But if it is for accumulating and marriage, then the facing should be towards the master. So this is the difference of facing the mandala. Page number 179. Here are the various traditional ways to fill the mandala. You take ease on the mandala base to be either the side facing the merit field, the beings to whom you make the offering, or the side facing you. During an offering mandala, take ease to be the side of mandala base facing the beings to whom you make the offering. Make ease the side facing you during a mandala of request. Continue on page number 179. The oceans in Mount Meru are surrounded by a circle of iron mountains. At their center stands Mount Meru, which is made out of 4 kinds of precious substances. The earth continent is white, the southern blue, the western red, and northern gold. Imagine there are vast quantities of precious mountains and the like on each particular continent. These precious mountains, which granting trees, etc., so these are actually listed on texts. I don't know whether they really exist or not. The wish-granting cow is by nature precious. Its urine and droppings are golden. On page number 180, the unplucked wild crop is a huxley's rice and so on. If harvested in the morning, it is grown again by evening. If harvested in the evening, it is grown again by morning. In the 25-heap mandala offering, you do not make separate heaps for each of these four things. They are implicitly included within the offering of the four continents. The seven precious symbols of regal power are mentioned in the venue, made of gold from Jambuva ocean. These seven things float in space, occupying the curtainal and sub-directions between the continents and Mount Meru. So the most important thing is we could offer anything, whether we own it or not. So this is the most important. Continue on page number 180, third para. The heaps representing the eight goddesses, the goddess of beauty, belong to the above 37 heap offering, although the goddesses themselves are supposed to be standing on the ledges around Mount Meru. But in the 25 heap version, you do not make any heaps to represent these goddesses, for you have already offered one to represent Mount Meru itself. The heap to represent the sun goes to the left of Mount Meru, that of the moon goes to right of the mountain, that of the precious parasol behind Mount Meru, the victory banner goes in front of the mountain and toward you. It is auspicious to do this. Alternately, you could put the suns in the west, the moon in the east, the parasols in the north, and the victory banner in the south. This is also auspicious. Page number 181, second para. Dabarambhishi says in his verse on the mantala, Brahma and Indra and the vow holder are the offering assistants. That is, he is saying you should imagine Brahma assists you. If you hold monks and nuns' vow, if you do not have these vows, you must have a fully ordained monk and Brahma helping you. But Mount Meru and the four continents were formed out of sentient beings' collective karma. You therefore do not need the help of Brahma and Indra to make the offering. The complete whole system of Mount Meru and continents are an environmental result of your own share of that collective karma. Visualize 1 billion sets of Mount Meru and four continents if you can imagine this visualization. If not, it is enough to visualize just one complete world system. If you offer the mandala properly, you gain the benefits of actually offering the four continents, Mount Meru and so on. For example, when Dharmaraja Ashoka was a child in the former rebirth, he put dirt in the Buddha Vibhashan's begging bowl, imagining this dirt was gold, yet he received the same benefits as offering real gold, and as a result, in his later rebirth as Ashoka, he built 10 million stupas in a single evening. Thus, there is nothing better than offering a vault mantala to accumulate merit. It completes your accumulations, it is convenient and straightforward to do, and so on. So this round copper base is a vital thing to have. At the end of the mantala offering, you either tilt the base toward you or away from you when you pour the contents back into their coal container. If you wish to receive more blessings, pour the contents toward you, pour it away from you when you seek to ward off interferences. Page number 182. Bhikshuni Lakshmi had a vision of Arya Avalokiteshvara after she had met a number of mantala offering. Jetsongkhapa strenuously met mantala offering and so on, while at Olga Trailing, as a result, developed the correct view. Thus, everyone should make an effort at doing this practice. Ajar Achandar Gomin said, if a calf is attractive to some grass and dry leaves at leaf of a deep well, he may not manage to reach them, but instead fall into the abyss. He who desires the pleasure of the worldly life is just like this. In other words, when an elephant goes to the edge of a terrifying cliff because of his attachment for the grass growing at the edge, he may fall over. When page number 183, Similarly, when we are attached to the happiness of this life alone, we commit various non-virtues, and eventually when we fall down the cliff to the lower realms, it will be hard for us ever to be free of them. We must therefore achieve our eternal hope. There is no better way of doing this than by properly following the stages of the path to enlightenment. We must set our motivation by thinking, I shall achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. So I shall listen to this Lamrim discourse and put it into practice. The meditation session is divided into three sections, the preliminary rites, the main part, and the conclusion. There are six preparatory rites. The fifth of this rite is offering, the seven limb prayer and the wall mantra. I have finished discussing the second of the seven limbs. The third limb, confession of sins. We do not develop in our mind stream any new realizations we have not already developed, and those who have already developed are degenerating. Our sins and obscurations are responsible for this. Further, our sins will be responsible for all the unfortunate things in this and our next life. If we do not want these things to happen, we must expiate our sins. Through confession, we can purify infinite amounts of karma, even the heinous crimes or great sins whose result we will normally have to undergo. The Vaibhashika system of tenets claim that one cannot purify such things, but the Prasangikas claim that one can. In Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, we find whoever was once reckless may later become scrupulous. They are then as calmly as a cloudless moon, just like Nanda, Angulimala, Ajatashatru, and Samkara. Page 185. We may be ordained, for example, yet leaving aside any major vows we may have broken, we not only break our other vows with the frequency of raindrops and a cloudburst, but also say that this does no harm. Yet not putting the lower garment of our robes on straight, for example, is all that is needed to break a major tantric vow. We also break the major bodhisattva vows as frequently as raindrops fall. Breaking a minor bodhisattva vow is 100,000 times more serious than breaking the major pratimoksha vow of a monk. Breaking a major bodhisattva vow is 100,000 times more serious than breaking a minor bodhisattva vow. Breaking a secondary tantric vow is 100,000 times more serious, and breaking a root tantric vow 100,000 times more serious still. So if we count of the mistakes we have done since, see we got of this morning, we will see we have many full sets of causes for rebirth in all the lower realms. Every day we are burdened with many mistakes, the 10 known virtues. We are told that the greatest of these will get us rebirth in the hell, the medium the rebirths as hungry ghosts, and the least the rebirths as animals. A great sin need not be killing a person and stealing their horse. It could even be calling your people a manky old dog in great fit of anger. Such things as criticizing karmically potent beings also become greater sins because of the object. So just today, we have acquired a complete set of causes to take us to the lower realms. Page number 186. Your sins are the source of all suffering in these and future lives, and if you can expiate them, you will rid yourself of suffering and develop realization and insights. For example, when you are sick in this rebirth, the thing causing you to undergo the illness is some known virtue you have already accumulated, so getting a ritual and so on performed on your behalf may not help, because the results of these rituals will ripen independently of the illness. but do not have the wrong view that such rituals are of no benefit. Suppose some peas are already growing in a field and use of barley there to stop the peas from growing any further. This would have about the same effect as the rituals. If a sin has already borne fruit, you can do nothing about it. You should therefore confess your sins before you experience their results. This is like destroying the seeds. If you confess your great sins and the sins whose result you were otherwise certain to experience in the lower realms, the outcome will be their ripening in this life as serious illness and so on. Those sins generally have no good qualities at all. They do have the property that they can be purified. In fact, there is no sin that cannot be purified through confession. The extent to which a sin will be purified is determined by the power of your intention. So Tom Temba has the illness of leprosy, but naturally he did not have the illness for himself, but he was assisting and helping many people who have the leprosy. Therefore, he got the illness. And to Cuban, when he was staying in Seri region, he looked after very poor people, especially infected with leprosy. And those near ones, he was helping them. And there's such accounts of histories. I met a Hindu sadhu in Bangalore during one of my meeting. And he showed me some of his life stories, a book. And within that book, I saw that he was helping many people, especially infected with leprosy. And he was washing the feet of those poor people infected with leprosy. Of course, if it is related with worldly concerns, it is different. Otherwise, that is really something that we have to be appreciated. Some Dharma practitioners in this life suffer from many undesirable things, continuing on page number 186. But this is best because it means that evil karma, whose result these practitioners will otherwise have experienced in future rebirth, has ripened on them in this life. An example of a practitioner suffering is Dom Temba, a true being of Dharma, who appeared to have contracted leprosy late in life. So do not hold wrong views, meditate on joy even when you get sick and so forth. You suffer an enormous loss if you destroy some of your virtue by anger. You also profit greatly from any sins you expiate. Page number 187. In order to purify a sin, you must have a full set of four opponent powers. The power of the basis is recognizing exactly to whom you will make confession. However, in our tradition, it means that because you accumulate a sin, so when we refer to the three poisons, so they are the main cause. So, of course, when we can make a confession with respect to the suffering that we have, especially suffering. But as a practitioner of Buddhist, we have to even see the negative side of those karmic results, those karmic imprints that it may even bring us to the higher realms. Because these karmas are again rooted in the grasping of self-existence or true existence. And as Panchen Losang Chukyi says, to understand the suffering nature of the samsara, the suffering of suffering is something even the animals can recognize. And the temporary happiness or the happiness or the suffering subject to change is something can be recognized or identified even by the non-Buddhists. Therefore, the main cause of the suffering, which is our human body, is to be recognized or identified or to be practiced or to be looked upon as suffering by only the Buddhist and the practitioners or the followers of Lord Buddha. So having such thinking and such visualization, then if we make a true confession, we have to really take refuge in the wisdom, understanding, emptiness. So when the poisons of the ignorance and the attachment and delusions overpower us, it's not only that we are reborn in the hell realms, but within the samsara, even with this body, we are born again and again. Page number 187, continuing, the power of regret, if you have this, you will also refrain from committing the sin again. You must know about the laws of cause and effect for this to happen with any force. Suppose three people have eaten poison food. One of them dies, one is taken ill, and one suffers no ill effects. The last person will have great remorse, try any means to get the poison out of his system. Lord Buddha has also instructed us vows to be taken for whole life, and also given instruction about taking the vow only for one day. So which are really very clever and very appropriate teaching. So if one is not able to take the vow for whole lifetime, then of course there are a set of vows that we can take even for one day. You must know about the laws of cause and effect for this to happen with any force. Sorry. The last para on page number 187. The power of refraining from recommitting misdeeds is restrained. You must do this properly. Your resolution must be extremely firm, and you should not remain apathetic after studying the benefits of confessing sins. You exercise restraint in the following way. The actions you are in danger of doing, such as using harsh language, also threaten to give the lie to your promise never to do such things again. If you do not exercise restraint, the four powers are not complete. Abandon to the very root the things you can abandon to their very root. There are still some things you can abandon for only a year, others you can abandon for only a month. But if you decide every day to abandon these things, you will then abandon things you can abandon for only one day. The point of training yourself this way is so that you can break the continuity of doing these things. This is a particularly skillful means, a most practical instruction from my own precious guru. Page number 188. You must make use of all four powers. The easiest of the six types of power of applying all antidotes is the actions done in relation to the names. It was the practice of past saints to make prostrations while reciting the confession of transgressions. The recitation contains all four powers and is so beneficial. Great Jerumbache, whose good works were as extensive as space itself, used it to build up his accumulations and perform self-purification. So it was Great Jerumbache's practice to perform his confession while prostrating and reciting the Sutra of the Three Noble Heaps. Even great adepts like Namkha Jensen of Lhotak purified their obscuration this way. All later scholar adepts did this practice, and the great adept Lobsang Namgyal said it was the noblest. When you have purified your sins, your mind is at ease, like someone who has stopped the interest on a huge loan. Page number 189. There are three oral instructions on how to recite the sutra. One is to recite the whole sutra from start to finish, the required number of times, or you could recite only the first section, starting with our teacher Buddha Shakyamuni and ending with Buddha, the king of the lot of mountains. The required number of times in this system, you only repeat the names a number of times and second part of the sutra. Or suppose you are going to recite the sutra 25 times in our one meditation session. This third instruction makes it easy to direct yourself to each Buddha and receive the individual help. As in the second system, after you have finished reciting the names, you need only go through the rest of the sutra once. Reciting the names of each Tathagata holds many benefits. Refer to relevant commentary such as the Tika to ascertain this. I think you all are not focusing to the text. So it's correct. All the repetitions of the word Tathagata in our version of confession of transgression do not appear in the original sutra, but it would not be right to recite the names of these Buddhas without an epithet. You must therefore add the title Tathagata before each of the names, as was Jerembichi's custom. Page number 190. You should then recite the general confession, or the like. This text says attachment, hostility. As in the classical treatises, their causes are the three poisons. The three doors are body, speech, and mind. Their nature would then be non-virtuous. When the confession of transgression says, I confess each and every sin, it means this is a way to confess transgressions of each of the three types of vows. Next para, the fourth limb, rejoicing. Rejoicing is a bodhisattva's practice, so it is difficult for us to do it even a little in our thoughts. But if we do this well, there is no better way to build up our accumulations. Once Surata, the beggar, rejoiced at the donations King Prasenajit made to the Buddha and his Charvakas. The beggar received more benefit than the king. As Jaya Tsongkhapa says, to give great impetus to your accumulation from the merest effort, they say best to rejoice all virtue. In other words, there is no need to wear out your body and voice, for you can collect an immeasurable stock of merit by rejoicing while at ease. King Prasenajit once asked the Buddha for teachings on some dharma that will be convenient for him to practice while he pursue his royal duties. He was told to practice three things: to rejoice, develop his bodhicitta, and dedicate his virtue. But once rejoicing must be without any jealous thoughts or competitiveness. If someone we dislike does something virtuous, we say out of jealousy, they're only doing it for form's sake. It is of no benefit at all. We should not do this. If we ordinary monks, for example, rejoice properly, when our roommate performs a 100-fold offering ceremony, we're sure to receive some benefit. If his level is lower than ours, we will receive twice the benefit that he did. If he is our equal, we get the same benefit. Even if he is higher, we are still certain to get half. What could be more profitable? And if we rejoice in the deeds of past Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and so on, we will receive a tenth of the benefits they gained because their mind streams are much higher than ours. If we elaborate virtuous practices for the whole of our human lifespan, continue on page number 191. The royal prayer of noble deeds say, I rejoice over all merits of the victors of the 10 directions, of their children, the Pratigya Buddhas, still learners and normal learners, and every other being. At this point, the gurus would treat this subject in the following order, rejoicing over such deeds as when the Buddhas developed bodhicitta for the first time, then rejoicing over the deeds of past scholars and adepts in India and Tibet, and rejoicing over even your roommate's recitations. However, there are two ways to meditate on this limb: rejoicing over your own virtue, rejoicing over the virtue of others. This is two subheadings, rejoicing over the virtue done in your past lives that you can discern by means of inferential valid cognition. Rejoicing over your virtues from this life that you can discern by means of direct valid cognition. Page 192. You have received a good physical rebirth in this life. Look at the favorable conditions you have inherited for Dharma practice and think. Over and over again, in my rebirths before this one, I must have upheld my ethics, practiced generosity, patience, etc., and done this extremely well. Because you were unmistaken in a previous life about how to do something meaningful for yourself, your present life is this magnificent, optimum human rebirth of yours. So now, O monk, you know just what rebirth your next one will be like. Some saints in the past said, your precious past life gave you your present precious human rebirth. So current precious monk, don't throw your future over the precipice. If we examine our present mode of behavior, you can see where you will be reborn in your future lives. We need not ask people with clairvoyant powers to perform divination and so on. Recall all the virtue you have personally performed, any recitations, any generosity, any service you have performed, any of your study, contemplation or listening, the rigors you have endured at any public ceremonies or debating practiced, and how you have upheld your ethics. Then without the feeling of arrogance, rejoicing over these things, your root virtues will lessen if you feel proud. This is the sort of calculation you should be doing. So in between this, rejoicing over the virtue of others is completed. The fifth limb requesting the veil of Dharma to be turned is also overt. Now we are on page number 194. Petitioning the merit field not to enter Nirvana. One sutra says the Buddhas never go into Nirvana. In other words, the Buddhas in general do not go into Nirvana, nor does the Dharma disappear. But to common appearances, the Supreme Nirmakaya enters Nirvana. One therefore must request Buddha, the teacher, not to go to Nirvana. It is a grievous fault not to do this. When Buddha was about to enter Nirvana, he said to Ananda, the Tathagatas have become much accustomed to cultivating the four fearlessnesses and four miraculous legs. Buddhists have achieved a watcher-like body, so they can live for an eon or more if they so wish. Ananda, however, did not catch the Buddha's meaning because he was influenced by a demon. Ananda therefore did not make this request to our teacher as a request. As a result, Buddha, to common appearances, went into Nirvana in his 80th year. So it is vital to make this request before it is too late. Here you should put five handfuls on your mandala base and imagine it to be a vajra throne. You could imagine you offer a vajra throne for each member of the merit field. Or if you cannot manage this, only one vajra throne that dissolves into merit field's throne. The royal prayer of noble did say, to those who, to common appearance, intend to go to their nirvana, with folded hands I plead, stay for as many eons as there are atoms in this world to help and bring happiness to all beings. While you perform the limb of petitioning and the limb of requesting, you should imagine the members of the merit field accepting both requests. It is vital then to dedicate one's merit. The Kadambas in their mind training texts say, the two things to do, one at the start, one at the end. This refers to setting one's motivation at the beginning and dedicating merit at the end. Dedications are necessarily a form of prayer, but for a prayer to be dedication, there must be something to be given in dedication. Page number 196. There are 6 points to be made here. What is being dedicated? Your root virtues. Why do you dedicate them? So that they will not run out. To what end do you dedicate them? To your supreme enlightenment. For whose sake do you dedicate them? For the sake of all sentient beings. How do you dedicate them? As it sees an ornament to realization through method and right perception. In other words, you perform the dedication with the sort of thinking that combines method and wisdom by having, for instance, right perception of the three components of the act of dedication. This prevents you from clinging to the thing being dedicated as if it were established as true. The nature of the dedication, it is done in conjunction with the wish that your root virtues may not disappear, do together with the wish that those virtuous health will change into the cause for your complete enlightenment. Page 197. If you do not dedicate, it could be destroyed when you get angry from engaging in the deed of bodhisattvas. No matter how many excellent deeds you may have performed for 1,000 eons, such as generosity or making offerings to Tathagatas, they all perish in one fit of anger. That is, anger destroys root virtues collected over 1,000 eons. Chandrakriti is engaging in the middle way, says, whenever you get angry at the Buddha's children, 100 eons virtue from giving and from ethics are destroyed in an instant. Here we are told that anger destroys root virtues collected over 100 eons. We destroy either 100 or 100 eons or the root virtues depending on the level of realization of one getting angry and the subject of the anger. The means to prevent one's root virtues from destroyed by anger is discussed in the sutra requested by Sagaramati, just as a drop of water poured into a great ocean will not disappear until the ocean runs dry. So too will virtue dedicated to perfect enlightenment not disappear before enlightenment is gained. Our root virtues are like the drop. The root virtues of the victorious ones and their children are like the ocean. We mix our root virtues with theirs when we dedicate them, and so these virtues will not have disappeared by the time we gain enlightenment. Page number 198. One sutra tells how to perform the dedication. Share them with all sentient beings. Ornament to realization says, the dedication to full enlightenment is the most supreme of actions, and that which has the objectless aspect is characterized as unmistaken. In other words, do this practice because it is extraordinary. It prevents one from clinging to things being established as true. The most well-known form of dedicating virtue to one's complete enlightenment is the thought, through this virtue may I achieve complete enlightenment for the sake of others. Just the same, we are sharing these root virtues with all sentient beings, and it is like mixing these virtues in the root virtues of the victorious one. Root virtues that resulted from their extensive deeds for the sake of others and that have never been known to run out. We offer our root virtues to contribute toward these deeds done for others' sakes, and so it is vital to pray that these virtues will take all sentient beings to enlightenment. Page 199. And in the prayer of noble deeds, what little virtue I have accumulated from homage, offerings, confession, rejoicing, requests, and petitions, I dedicate it all to my enlightenment. In other words, this is a dedication to the result, your complete enlightenment. but both the cause of holding the holy Dharma in your mind stream and the result of doing this, achieving complete enlightenment, depend on your being looked after by a spiritual guide. So we will stop here for today. By the merits accumulated by giving teaching, may Buddha's teaching live for long.
Boy, Lord, 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 L you.